From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! The Toronto Declaration, no celebration of occupation. A protest at the Toronto International Film Festival takes center stage after a group of artists and writers sign a letter against the festival's decision to spotlight the city of Tel Aviv. Over 1,500 people have signed, including Jane Fonda, Viggo Mortensen, Danny Glover, and Harry Belafonte. We'll speak with journalist and author Naomi Klein, who helped draft the letter. We'll also talk to her about her Harper's Magazine cover story, Minority Death Watch, Jews, Blacks, and the, quote, post-racial presidency. Then a massive New York Times investigation finds chemical companies have violated the Clean Water Act more than 500,000 times in the last 5 years. An estimated 1 in 10 Americans has been exposed to drinking water that has dangerous chemicals or falls short of federal standards. Most of the violations have gone unpunished. We'll speak with a New York Times reporter who broke the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States and five partner countries have accepted Iran's new offer to hold talks, even though Iran insists it will not negotiate over its disputed nuclear program. The talks are expected to start in early October. If successful, this would be the first formal substantive talks between the United States and Iran since the Iranian Revolution 30 years ago. Iran last week handed over a package of proposals to the world powers, in which Tehran said it was willing to discuss global nuclear disarmament as well as other international issues in wide-ranging talks. But the document did not mention Iran's own nuclear program, which Iran maintains is only for civil energy uses. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs insisted that Iran's nuclear program will be discussed at the talks.
Certainly their willingness to talk about it is welcome. I'll tell you this. We're not talking for talking's sake. This may not have been a topic that they wanted to be brought up, but I can assure you it's a topic that that we'll bring up and the P5 plus one will bring up. The Iranians have responsibilities to the international community to walk away from their illicit nuclear weapons program. That's what the focus from our side will be on in these talks, and that's our goal.
A federal appeals court has rejected a lawsuit filed by four former Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib against the military contractor Khaki International. The men had accused the firm's employees of taking part in the torture and abuse of prisoners. In a 2-to-1 ruling, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit dismissed the case on the grounds that Khaki should be immune from prosecution because the company's employees were under U.S. military authority. The dissenting opinion was written by Judge Merrick Garland. He argued there's no judicial precedent that would prohibit the detainees from suing government contractors. Garland wrote, quote, "The plaintiffs in these cases allege they were beaten, electrocuted, raped, subjected to attacks by dogs, and otherwise abused by private contractors. At the current stage of the litigation, we must accept these allegations as true," unquote. The top commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan has admitted he sees no signs of a major al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan. Speaking on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, General Stanley McChrystal said, quote, "I do not see indications of a large al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan now." But McChrystal says al-Qaeda still maintains close links to Afghan-based insurgents. He's expected to soon ask President Obama to send more troops to Afghanistan. More accusations have been aired about Afghanistan's recent presidential election. Afghan presidential candidate Abdullah Abdullah claims incumbent President Hamid Karzai used state resources to engineer the stealing of the August 20th presidential election. Abdullah says Karzai bribed tribal elders between $4,000 and $8,000 each to throw the election to Karzai. In other news from Afghanistan, the New York Times reports the Obama administration plans to issue new guidelines aimed at giving hundreds of prisoners in Afghanistan more ability to challenge their custody. However, the prisoners will not be given access to attorneys. Instead, the Pentagon plans to assign a U.S. military official to each prisoner. The official could help gather witnesses and evidence, including classified material on behalf of the detainees, to challenge their detention and proceedings before a military-appointed review board. Tens of thousands of right-wing activists gathered in Washington Saturday to condemn President Obama's plan to reform health care. Many protesters praised Republican Congressman Joe Wilson for calling the president a liar during his speech to Congress last night.
You lie!
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 Organizers had projected as many as 2 million protesters would attend, but the D.C. Fire Department put the final tally at approximately 60 to 70,000. Organizers included the Tea Party Patriots, ResistNet, and Freedom Works. The Washington-based organization headed by former House Majority Leader Richard Armey of Texas. The march was also heavily publicized by Fox News host Glenn Beck. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis Saturday, 15,000 supporters of President Obama filled the Target Center to hear Obama speak.
If we do nothing, your premiums will continue to rise faster than your wages. If we do nothing, more businesses will close down. Fewer will be able to open in the first place. If we do nothing, we will eventually spend more on Medicare and Medicaid than every other government program combined. That's not an option for the United States of America. So, Minnesota, I may not be the first president to take up the cause of health care reform, but I am determined to be the last. We are going to get it done this year.
The State Department has revoked the visas of more than a dozen members of the coup government in Honduras, including the country's installed president, Roberto Micheletti, and 14 members of the Honduran Supreme Court. The move comes more than 2 months after a military coup ousted the democratically elected Manuel Zelaya. Here in this country, six groups have filed a federal lawsuit after being denied permits to protest during the G20 summit in Pittsburgh later this month. The suit was filed against the city, the Secret Service, and the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Attorney Witold Walczak of the Attorney of the American Civil Liberties Union said, quote, "What they're essentially doing is refusing permits for any demonstration in downtown Pittsburgh, and that's unprecedented," he said. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced it'll scrutinize 79 applications for mountaintop coal mine permits in Appalachia to guard against damage to water supplies. The move was praised by environmental groups and critics of mountaintop removal. Michael Brune of Rainforest Action Network said, quote, "By recognizing the irreversible destruction caused by mountaintop removal coal mining, the EPA has taken an important stand in support of the people and ecosystems of Appalachia. The agency seems to recognize there is no environmentally safe way to demolish mountains," he said. In Michigan, police have arrested a 33-year-old man named Harlan Drake on murder charges for allegedly killing two men Friday, including a longtime anti-abortion activist. The activist, James Pilon, was shot to death while staging a protest in front of the Owosso High School. President Obama and several pro-choice groups condemned the killing. Six anti-war activists were arrested at a mall in Philadelphia Saturday during a protest to shut down a video arcade run by the military that's also used as a recruiting center. The Army Experience Center is a high-tech arcade that houses 80 video gaming stations and battle simulations. More than 50 nations gathered in Mexico last week to take part in the 62nd annual Peace and Development Conference organized by the United Nations. Hiroshima Mayor Tadatoshi Akiba, whose city was destroyed by a nuclear bomb in 1945, predicted an end to nuclear weapons by 2020.
I firmly believe, I'm confident, and I know that we can abolish nuclear weapons by 2020. You know, it's a gigantic task. It is a once-in-a-century event. Therefore, when that happens in 2020, that calls for a gigantic celebration. And I cannot think anything better than holding an Olympic game. An Olympic game in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to celebrate the triumph of the people of the world, to celebrate a nuclear-free world.
And in Cuba, tens of thousands lined up Sunday to pay their respects to Juan Almeida, a hero of the country's 1959 revolution. Almeida died on Friday at the age of 82. He was at the side of Fidel and Raul Castro from the earliest days of the revolution and was the only black commander in the leadership. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Toronto International Film Festival's renowned as one of the world's top cinematic events, the staging ground for the top films in any given year. But since the festival's opening last week, a protest over the Israel-Palestine conflict has taken center stage. At issue is the festival's decision to host a showcase on Israeli films from Tel Aviv for its inaugural city-to-city program. Palestinian activists say the TIFF spotlight plays into Israel's attempt to improve its global image in the wake of the assault on the Gaza Strip and the ongoing occupation of Palestinian land. In the weeks before the festival, a group of artists and writers drafted a letter of protests against the Tel Aviv spotlight. The letter is called The Toronto Delegation, No Celebration of Occupation. It says in part, quote, "Whether intentionally or not, TIFF has become complicit in the Israeli propaganda machine. We do not protest the individual Israeli filmmakers, nor do we in any way suggest that Israeli films should be unwelcome at TIFF. However, especially in the wake of this year's brutal assault on Gaza, we object to the use of such an important international festival in staging a propaganda campaign on behalf of an apartheid regime," unquote. The declaration has attracted over 1,500 signatories, including actors Jane Fonda, Viggo Mortensen, and Danny Glover, musician David Byrne, and the actor and musician Harry Belafonte. But it's been met with scathing criticism and accusations of anti-Semitism. Supporters of the Israeli government have accused the Toronto Declaration members of a slew of false charges, including that they want to boycott Israeli films and even the entire festival itself. Well, the journalist Naomi Klein was one of the original authors of the Toronto Declaration. She joins us now in our Firehouse studio. And Naomi, just lay out the whole conflict and how you got involved and what this declaration is.
Absolutely. And I'll just, thanks for having me back, Amy. I just want to make one tiny correction, which is that the letter doesn't call Israel an apartheid state. It says that this is a state that many respected people have described as an apartheid state, like Jimmy Carter, Desmond Tutu. So it invokes them and it quotes them. And I think that's an important distinction, because what we're trying to pull out in this letter is that this is a controversial decision. And the people who signed it are saying exactly what the declaration is called, that they don't believe this is a time of celebration, that the 42-year occupation continues. But moreover, this is the year that began in January with bombs and missiles falling on Gaza, leading to the deaths of an estimated 1,400 people, many of them children. There's been no accountability for those crimes. Israel continues to refuse to cooperate, even with a basic UN fact-finding mission led by the respected South African judge, Richard Goldstone. So we are very clear. This is not about whether or not there are Israeli films at the Toronto International Film Festival. Every year there are. Of course there should be. They're welcome. If the films are wonderful, they should win honors. What's happening at the Toronto International Film Festival this year is that not films, but a city is being honored, the city of Tel Aviv. The mayor of Tel Aviv is in Toronto being feted because this is seen as something that's really good for Israeli tourism. So this is really departing from the realm of arts and entering the realm of politics and industry in this decision to grant this honor and this privilege to the city of Tel Aviv. So that's why people started objecting to it. And it wasn't us who started it. It was Palestinians who rejected to the granting of this special status, this honor status for the state of Israel in this year's festival.
Explain why the Toronto International Film Festival is celebrating Tel Aviv.
Well, this is a controversial question. The Cameron Bailey, the co-director of the festival, says that it was entirely his decision, that there was no political interference, and we take him at his word. He's very respected in the film community. But what we are saying is that whether knowingly or not, this decision fits in with a campaign, a very aggressive campaign that has been launched by Israel's foreign ministry to use culture really as a weapon to distract attention from the occupation and from the allegations of war crimes in Gaza, but even before the Gaza attack. And what's interesting is that Toronto has been selected to test market something that is called Brand Israel, the rebranding of Israel. And this is because Toronto has really been a kind of a battleground. It has a very strong Palestinian community and solidarity community. It also has a very large and active Jewish community, and it's been a battle zone. So actually, Canada has more Israeli diplomats than any other country in the world, because this, including the United States, despite our relatively small population, because the Israeli government sees Canada as a very important battleground, as a very important testing ground. So Toronto has been selected to sort of test drive this rebranding campaign for Israel. And, you know, it's not our imagination. It's not a quiet conspiracy. It's this. We've read about this in the New York Times and Reuters reports. And I'll just give you one example. A couple of months after the attack on Gaza, as we remember, this was really a turning point in terms of world opinion with regards to Israel. There were protests around the world. In London, there were an estimated 100,000 people in the streets condemning Israel's actions. Opinion polls were showing a plummeting of support. And more people were starting to talk about using tactics like the tactics that were used against South Africa during the apartheid years, that's saying that there has to be strategies beyond just talk. And so it was in this context that a top official in Israel's foreign ministry said, and this was quoted in the New York Times, "We will send well-known novelists and writers overseas, theater company exhibits. This way you show Israel's prettier face, so we are not thought of purely in the context of war." And so this has been playing out at a lot of cultural festivals, and you've covered this on the show before, the Paris Book Fair, which is an enormously important book festival, had a special spotlight on Israel for its 60th birthday a couple of years ago. The Turin Book Fair also did. But this, and there were protests, but they were much quieter than what's happened now in Toronto, and that's because of Gaza, I would say. It's because now, because of the year that we're in, because of the continued impunity for Israeli war crimes, people are drawing a line and saying this is no time to celebrate.
Respond to Ivan Reitman, the film director, who said film is essentially about telling global stories, of exploring the complexities and contradictions of the human condition. Any attempt to silence that conversation, to hijack the festival for any political agenda, in the end only serves to silence artistic voices.
You know, I would actually agree with that statement, but it isn't us who did that. We didn't politicize the festival. We objected to the politicization of the festival. We're not trying to silence anyone by simply voicing our opposition to the festival's decision to grant Israel this special status. You know, when we looked into this whole rebranding strategy, Jewish Voices for Peace, the terrific anti-occupation San Francisco-based organization, JVP.org, they've done produced this great document, a fact check of all the lies that are being spread about our campaign that I really urge people to look up. But they talk about, they have some documents talking about this rebranding campaign and the goals of it, and they quote a top PR official in Israel saying that the real goal is to create a narrative of normalcy. That's a quote, a narrative of normalcy around Israel. So you can sort of, you can have a tiny little compartment where you can criticize Israel's actions in Gaza or the expansion of settlements, but when it comes to every other part of Israeli society, we have to act like nothing is going on. We should, of course, celebrate Tel Aviv in a film festival, and at book festivals and so on, and promote Israel. Israeli tourism. So what has happened with TIFF is that TIFF is the film festival.
Toronto International.
Yeah,
film.
Is that they convinced themselves that it was normal just to have a celebration for the city of Tel Aviv in this of all years, and when people objected to that, led by Palestinians, they turned around and said, "You're politicizing the film festival," because I think they have really convinced themselves that there is nothing abnormal about this decision, and we're saying, if this were any other country, it would be so obvious that this was a political decision that amounts to taking sides in a conflict. And I'll just give you one example. Imagine that this year the Toronto International Film Festival had decided to have a cinematic spotlight, a cinematic homage, as Haaretz described this program, on the city of Colombo. With the full blessing of the Sri Lankan government, overwhelmingly Sinhalese-dominated, not a single Tamil director, just as there's not a single Palestinian director in this spotlight. Now, Toronto has a huge population, a huge Tamil population, very active. They would have been protesting outside because it would have been perceived as a sort of a whitewash in a year that the Sri Lankan government rightly stands accused of war crimes. For some reason, Israel is supposed to be the exception, and we are accused of singling out Israel, but in fact what we're doing, and when you look at the people who've signed our letter, like Howard Zinn, Harry Belafonte, Eve Ensler, these are people who've devoted their lives to applying human rights standards across the board. What they're not singling out Israel. What they're saying is we insist on applying the same standards that we apply to every other country, to Israel as well. And just as we wouldn't celebrate another country that stands accused of war crimes, we don't believe it's apolitical to celebrate Israel. And there's been this insistence, and I don't think it's a misunderstanding, I think it's a strategy, to turn this into a debate over censorship, because everybody hates censors. You know, everybody wants to celebrate world cinema and so on. Nobody's calling for the boycott of TIFF. Nobody's trying to silence any films. But it's much easier to sort of try to derail the conversation and turn it into a censorship battle. And that's what the quote you just read is trying to do very deliberately.
So you have these two quotes. You have one of the signers of the Toronto Declaration, Viggo Mortensen, who says, let's see if I can find the quote. The statement does not promote the boycotting or censorship of any artist or movie from Israel or anywhere else. Those who have attacked the statement with that accusation are simply spreading misinformation, unfortunately continuing the ongoing successful distraction from the issue at hand. The Israeli government's whitewashing of their illegal and inhumane actions inside and outside their legal national borders. And then you have the award-winning filmmaker Robert Lantos, who says, we are not talking about the West Bank or the Golan Heights here, but the biggest population center in the heart of Israel, where the first neighborhood was built in 1887. If that's disputed territory, then Ms. Klein and her armchair stormtroopers are clamoring for nothing short of the annihilation of the Jewish state. They are effectively Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's local fifth column.
Yeah, it's been a fun week, I have to say. yeah, that's actually the most powerful man in Canadian film and media saying that. And it's an extraordinary lie on every level. I mean, there are so many lies in that statement. The reason why we're not singling out Tel Aviv. The festival singled out Tel Aviv, and it's acting as if this is an apolitical decision. When you read the program, it says Tel Aviv is the economic and cultural center of Israel and doesn't mention occupation once, actually doesn't mention Palestinians once. It's just this sort of light, frothy, breezy discussion of a city filled with cafes. And it even says, there's an interview with one of the filmmakers who talks about Tel Aviv is a place where you can go when you don't want to think about the conflict 24/7. So it's really this idea that you can sort of lift Tel Aviv out of the context of Israel, out of the context of the conflict, and just turn it into this apolitical space. The defense ministry is located in Tel Aviv. Fighter jets during the bombing of Gaza departed from the Air Force very close to Tel Aviv, and people protested, Israeli peace activists protested at the airbase and to try to reach the pilots and tell them, you know, what you're going about to do is commit war crimes. This, you can't lift Tel Aviv out of Israel. And the idea that by objecting to the spotlight, we're objecting to the existence of Tel Aviv, which is what he's saying, is just diversion on a mass scale. And it's very, very unfortunate because, as you said, you know, people like Jane Fonda have signed the letter. And the most dishonest smear campaign has been launched, directed at them. There was a headline on a bunch of gossip sites like TMZ and Perez Hilton last week that literally said Jane Fonda calls for the destruction of the state of Israel, which is so absurd. This is somebody who supported a two-state solution her whole life. And this is not a misunderstanding, once again. This is about discrediting everyone who dares to speak out on Israel, who dares to reject this narrative of normalcy. And the truth really appears not to matter.
Naomi Klein, we're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Naomi Klein, journalist, author of The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. She helped launch the No Celebration of Occupation protest at the Toronto International Film Festival that's taking place as we speak. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 8 Hensha stations, on Pacific and NPR, and low-power FM and college and community stations, and on public access TV and PBS TV stations in both TV satellite networks. Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines also available in Spanish for any radio station to take. And you can go there to read the full transcripts of the headlines in Spanish and the full transcripts of every show in English as well. We are joined by Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. She has a cover story of Harper's Magazine, as well as a big piece in The Guardian in Britain. Naomi, you went to Gaza earlier this summer to witness the aftermath of the Israeli attack on Gaza. I wanted to play the comments of Jessica Montel, executive director of the Israeli Human Rights Group at Selam. Last week, the group released a report on the toll from the Gaza assault. The report backs Palestinian findings that over half the 1,400 Palestinian victims were civilians, including 240 children.
The discrepancy between what the Israeli army has reported and what B'Tselem's research has revealed is quite disturbing. The most blatant example regarding children under the age of 16, the Israeli military has claimed that 89 Palestinian children under 16 were killed in Operation Cast Lead. B'Tselem visited families, took death certificates, testimonies, other information from the families on 240 Palestinian children under 16 killed.
That's Jessica Montel of B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group. Naomi, you recently came back from Gaza. And just before we go to your piece on Jews, blacks, and the, quote, post-racial presidency in Harper's, I want to ask you about that trip.
Well, in many ways, this is for me, this is why I'm involved in this whole mess around the Toronto International Film Festival, because when I was in Gaza, I was so struck by the fact that Gazans felt that people had forgotten them, and I was told something that really stayed with me. I was working with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. They were taking me around, and we had a discussion with a group of NGO leaders, women's rights leaders. And one of the things that was said to me was that there was actually more hope during the attack, which seemed than there was now, than there was in the aftermath, which just blindsided me. I mean, how could you say that? How could you say that there was more hope while bombs and missiles were falling when those children were being killed than there is now? And the answer was that when Gazans turned on their televisions, you know, in any kind of war, people who can are watching television to try to get any kind of information they can or listen to the radio. And in addition to the carnage that they were hearing about, they were also hearing reports of a world enraged. They were hearing about those protesters in London, in cities around the world, just rejecting Israel's actions, not buying that this was a defensive war. They heard reports of women in my city, in Toronto, occupying the consul general's office. Jewish women did this and stayed, and it was an incredible action. And so what I was told by people who I spoke to in Gaza was that there was a feeling that if they could survive these horrific attacks, this would be the turning point, that people were seeing the lawlessness, the brutality of the occupation, and there would be a demand for a new era, that the siege on Gaza, for instance, would have to be lifted. Here they were 6 months later, now 8 months later, and the illegal siege on Gaza continued. There was no justice on the way. I mean, Gaza was felt to me like a massive crime scene, but that was being tampered with because the police hadn't shown up. And just the outrage that such brutality, such open brutality, hadn't led to any kind of justice. And that's really what struck with me. So when I got back to the city where I live, Toronto, and found out that we were planning to throw a big party for the State of Israel at our premier cultural event, the Toronto International Film Festival, that's what prompted me to get involved in this protest. Not that I enjoy being called Ahmadinejad's fifth column. I really don't. But, you know, I feel a sort of moral responsibility having witnessed this sense from so many people in Gaza that these terrible crimes that we just heard about from B'Tselem had been forgotten, and that there was no justice. And when governments fail, you know, when the international community fails, when the UN fails to bring justice, then people have to step in and fill that gap, that vacuum. And that's happened in the past, and it's going to happen again. And this is, I think, why there is such an incredible fear and backlash against attempts to put other kinds of pressure on the state of Israel, not to just leave it up to Obama to talk to Netanyahu and hope that it works out. You know, people are seeing the failure of just high-level moral suasion. And we know that there are other tools in the diplomatic arsenal besides just talk, you know, besides just Obama suggesting to Netanyahu that maybe he shouldn't build more settlements and Netanyahu proceeding to ignore him. There's billions in military aid. There are all of these honors that are given to countries and all of these relationships. And all of them are treated, as, when it comes to Israel, as completely untouchable. And there is an international movement that's growing that is saying, actually, they're not untouchable. We need to use all of these levers in the case of Israel, just as we have the right to use them in the case of any other country that refuses to abide by international law.
On a related topic, I want to turn now to your piece in Harper's Magazine. The World Conference Against Racism was held in Geneva this past April, a follow-up to the first racism conference in Durban, South Africa, that took place, well, right before the September 11 attacks, actually. Yeah. It was in the midst of that. Well, unlike Toronto, this time there was a major boycott. The Obama administration refused to attend, claiming the conference would unfairly target Israel. Several other countries joined in, despite the fact that the declaration ultimately contained no criticism of Israel. Instead, it reaffirmed a conference text from 2001 that recognizes the Palestinian right to self-determination and calls for a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Critics say the controversy over Israel could have been an excuse to avoid dealing with the conference's key issues, including addressing the legacy of slavery. Well, the piece you wrote in Harper's, Minority Death Watch, Minority Death Match, Jews, Blacks, and the, quote, post-racial presidency, goes through what happened, 8 years ago, and how it was cast. Talk about it.
Well, I always find it fascinating that this is what the world was talking about right before September 11th, that in a sense, September 11th interrupted violently this conversation that was taking place. And, you know, in the United States, the discussion was far less about Israel, although that was an issue at the conference, and much more about the issue of reparations for slavery. This was the issue in 2001. It was the hot issue on CNN and on all the talk shows. This was the hot issue on campuses. I mean, this has been sort of erased from history, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to retell the story of Durban and take it out of this misinformation campaign. You know, in the lead up to Durban 2, you couldn't find an article about this conference. Durban 2 is what the follow-up conference in Geneva was described as. You couldn't find a reference to it without the pairing of the word hate fest. It was just universally described as a hate fest. People believed that this conference was equating Zionism with racism. It absolutely was not. The conference in 2001 did not. And it was an enormously important forum. This was the only UN gathering of its kind which looked frontally at racism. And to me, what was so striking about this as well is that, you know, in the middle of an economic crisis, and we're certainly in one, this is a time when we know that racist ideas spread. We know this historically. So it seemed to me an extraordinary decision on the part of the Obama administration and all of these Western European governments, my government, Canada, Australia, to say, as they did in April, we are not going to talk about racism because we don't like a couple of things that may or may not be on the agenda. To me, it seemed reckless. I mean, this is a time, you know, across Europe, far-right parties are rising. Look at what's happening in this country with rampant racism directed at Obama himself. And there was just this decision, we're not going to talk about it.
Your piece begins in Harper's, where you are visiting the offices of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. Mm-hmm. Explain what happened as you were there, as the hours unfolded.
Well, I had this interview set up with Navi Pillay, who is the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and that means that she's in charge of this conference. This is her conference. Just as in 2001, it was Mary Robinson who had her job, and she was in charge of the first Durban conference. So we had this interview set up the day before the conference was set to open, and. When I arrived, she was having an extremely rough morning because she had just gotten the news that the Obama administration was definitively boycotting the conference. More than that, as soon as the Obama administration announced that, all of these other countries started dropping like dominoes. So she had been on the phone nonstop trying to prevent a full-scale walkout by the entire European Union, which would have meant no conference whatsoever. And she was drafting a press conference condemning the U.S. actions when I walked into the office. And they did manage to stop the walkout, the wholesale walkout from the conference. But of course, the big distraction at the event, I'm sure many of your viewers and listeners remember, was that Ahmadinejad was the only world leader who decided to come to the conference. And this was related to this attack campaign. No senior officials wanted to be there because it had been so effectively smeared. And so while he was speaking, all of these EU officials walked out in droves. And that became the only thing we heard about Geneva. It was just Ahmadinejad, the EU walkout, some French students had clown wigs on. A friend of mine texted me. I was in the press gallery while this was happening, while they were walking out, and she said it looks like a fire drill, like all these people walking, running for the doors. Sort of this. I think that these guys all thought they were Winston Churchill. They were standing up to the neo-Nazi threat, and they felt very, very smug, very, very good about themselves. But the feeling, my feeling at the time was that. They didn't want to be in the room anyway. I mean, none of these Western governments relish the opportunity of talking about their own race relations records. So Ahmadinejad gave them the perfect excuse to flee. There was a sort of amazing convergence of interests going on in that room.
And Naomi Klein, in your article in Harper's, you quote the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Yigal Palmor. Mm-hmm. One day before the conference opened, he was interviewed by the BBC radio. During the interview, he was questioned for asserting that the Durban conference declaration singled out Israel.
Look, in the previous conference, Israel was singled out as the most racist state on earth, probably almost the only racist state, and all the problems that we were facing here in the Middle East were not historical or political or military or geographical or anything else. They were all attributable to one unique factor, Israel's innate racism.
This was speakers, was it, at the Durban conference rather than any final declaration?
No, it was also included in the final declaration.
Because I've been looking at that final declaration and I can see nothing that comes anywhere near to what you are saying.
I don't have the text in front of me.
Well, I do have the text in front of me, and I can see nothing that comes close to what you are saying. I can see a final declaration that speaks out against anti-Semitism, that says we will never forget the Holocaust, that says we are concerned about the plight of the Palestinian people, but nonetheless recognize the right to security for all states in the region, including Israel, and call upon states to support the peace process and bring it to an early conclusion. That is a mention of Israel in the final declaration.
Right. I'm not sure we're talking about the same conference, because even though I don't have the text in front of me, I remember quite precisely some quotes that were completely contrary to those that you've just quoted. So we must be speaking about two different documents.
That was Julian Marshall of the BBC interviewing the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Yigal Palmor. Your response, you write about this interaction, Naomi Klein.
Yeah, because this Julian Marshall was seemingly the only journalist who had actually read the declaration. And what's relevant about this is that when the Obama administration announced that they would be boycotting the Durban Review Conference in Geneva, this is 3 months into the Obama administration, in a context where the Congressional Black Caucus had made this a major, major priority. Barbara Lee had gone to extraordinary lengths, and other members of the Congressional Black Caucus, to make sure that there was nothing in the declaration that in any way singled out Israel. I mean, many argued that they had taken out too much, that they'd made too many concessions to create a context where the Obama administration would feel comfortable coming. There was no mention of reparations for slavery, didn't talk about the slave trade as a crime, no mention of Israel whatsoever. No mention of the defamation of religion, which was another demand of some Muslim countries. This was also controversial, seen as a threat to free speech, so that wasn't in there. So there was no reason not to go. I mean, Barbara Lee and the Congressional Black Caucus had managed an incredible negotiating feat. There was no reason not to go now. And so the only thing the Obama administration came up with is that in the declaration, this is the declaration for the new conference, the conference that just happened in Geneva, they said it reaffirmed the old declaration. And the old declaration was so unfair to Israel, as you just heard from the Israeli spokesperson, that they couldn't go. And Obama himself made this argument. And so what was so striking is that no journalist went back and read that declaration, except this BBC journalist who put him on the spot saying, where does it say all these terrible things about Israel? And in fact, it says Israel has a right to security. It recognizes the importance of remembering the Holocaust. It's actually quite a banal document. It says nothing that any government would object to, including the Obama administration. I mean, Joe Biden has gone further than this document. So what you really see here is the success of an extraordinary misinformation campaign that was launched in the aftermath of the first Durban conference to discredit. And into a very, very important forum because it was seen as potentially a threat to Israel because it could potentially apply international law to Israel, and it didn't. They would use any misinformation to discredit the gathering.
As we wrap up, I wanted to go to your Guardian piece in London, the piece that you call, or that they called for you, Obama's Big Silence, as the president turned his back on Black America, dealing with all of the latest issues, even in these last few weeks in the Obama administration.
Well, I mean, I think we know this summer really has been a turning point, that the myth of post-racial America is, I think, definitively buried. This was the sort of euphoria after the election of Barack Obama. We heard again and again that the country had entered into a post-racial era, was no longer important to talk about race. This whole summer has been about race, starting with the accusations that Sotomayor is a racist, then turning on Obama telling the truth that the police actions in the arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. in his home, the police actions were stupid or had acted stupidly, whatever the phrase he'd use, that made him a racist. I mean, this summer has been obsessed with race. And the undercurrent of the protests against Obama around health care, really, a lot of them use this language of, you know, he wants to take what's ours and redistribute it. And there's often discussion, you know, people like Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, often invoke reparations to accuse Obama of being obsessed with race, and that he has this covert agenda, apparently, of taking white wealth and giving it to Black people. I think the phrase that Limbaugh used was secret reparations. And what's so ironic about this, actually, is that, in fact, Obama has completely turned his back on the entire reparations discussion, which is what was happening in 2001. And John Conyers, as we know, has tried to get H.R. 40, the resolution that would open up a discussion on what kind of reparations are due to African Americans. Often people think that people are talking about a check in the mail. And in fact, what most reparations activists are talking about overwhelmingly are group solutions, investments, in communities, in education, in healthcare, precisely the programs that are missing from the Obama administration in its response to the current economic crisis, which, let's remember, began because of the enormous wealth gap, the net worth gap between minority communities and the dominant sectors of society. Because people did not have access to traditional credit, and this is a direct legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, they turned to subprime lenders and were discriminated against by traditional lenders, and that this is really the root of the current crisis, was those terrible loans that then were bet against. So what we see is that the failure to deal with the income gap, the continued income gap, which is the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, actually is at the very heart of our financial crisis. So we have a collective interest in addressing that gap. Not only has it not been addressed, but the economic crisis has affected blacks and Latinos disproportionately. I mean, you've covered this on the show very, very well again and again, that it is these communities that were already facing this discrimination, which is why they had those bad loans, that are overwhelmingly facing the foreclosures, facing the job losses. So that gap, that wealth gap, that race-wealth divide, as it's often called, is widening in the midst of the crisis. And the Obama administration is absolutely refusing to talk about the need for policies that will look at this specifically, at closing the gap. It's insisting on treating everybody as if they're equal. So we're in this very awkward position where the right is accusing Obama of being, this radical reparations advocate at the same time as he won't even talk about the basic need to address the race-wealth divide. It's a very, very difficult moment, I think, for race relations.
Naomi Klein, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Journalist and author, her books include The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. Her article, Minority Death Match, appears in Harper's Magazine. And her piece, Obama's Big Silence, is in The Guardian of London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're going to look at water in our next segment with New York Times reporter who's done a major expose. Stay with us.
If your child they grow, the water him go use. If water kill your child, the water you go use. Tell me back mama when you me not low malo. Cause someone to the shake, oh malo me oh. Nothing without water. Cause someone to the shake.
Water got no get enemy, Fela Kuti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For our last segment, we turn to a new look at the severity of water contamination here in the United States. An investigation by the New York Times has found chemical companies have violated the Clean Water Act more than 500,000 times in the last 5 years. Most of the violations have gone unpunished, with state regulators taking significant action in just 3% of all cases. Although some of the cases entailed minor violations, a majority of 60% were deemed to be in significant noncompliance. These cases are of the most serious and include the dumping of cancer-causing chemicals or failing to measure or report pollution. An estimated 1 in 10 Americans has been exposed to drinking water that has dangerous chemicals or falls short of federal standards. 40% of the nation's community water systems violated the Safe Drinking Water Act, and at least once exposing over 23 million people to potential danger. The investigation was published 2 days after the Environmental Protection Agency announced it would freeze permits for 79 mountaintop removal sites pending a review of their compliance with the Clean Water Act. The move affects mines in 4 states, Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, and Tennessee. Charles Duhigg is the New York Times reporter who is carrying out this investigation. His article appeared in Sunday's edition of the New York Times. It's called Clean Water Laws Are Neglected at a Cost in Suffering. Charles Duhigg joins me here in the Firehouse Studio. Welcome to Democracy
Now!
Thank
you so much for having me. Really
a remarkable expose. Just lay it out for us.
Well, we spent about 10 months collecting records from every single state in the EPA trying to figure out exactly what was going on with the nation's waters. And what we discovered was that the Clean Water Act was passed about almost 4 decades ago with the intent of giving regulators the power to monitor what goes into our waterways and then punish people who violate their permits. And everyone who dumps something into a waterway has to have a permit. And what we found is that only about 3% of people who violate their permits ever get punished. And so, somewhat unsurprisingly, the rate of violations has gone up significantly because companies and workplaces know that they can break the Clean Water Act without getting punished for it.
You begin your piece in West Virginia.
That's right. We focus on West Virginia for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a microcosm of the problems that have been around this issue. It's a national issue, and states all over the country confront this. But in West Virginia in particular, you see a real struggle and tension between industries, most particularly coal extraction, which is West Virginia's largest industry, and the environmental priorities of people who want to protect waterways. And so there's a number of communities in West Virginia that are really suffering because their water has been, they claim, ruined by the practices of nearby coal companies. And the state agency has, the environmental agency has been less vigorous in protecting it.
Tell us about Jennifer Hallmassey.
Jennifer's she's a mother of two kids in right outside Charleston, West Virginia, which is the state capital. And so this isn't sort of, you know, some dark corner of Appalachia. Around her home are mountains that have been mined for coal for years. One of the things that coal companies do is they, when they extract coal, they wash it. And the water, and they put chemicals in it to take out the impurities. The waste that's left over, the water, is called sludge or slurry, and it contains all these dissolved minerals and chemicals. They put those in these big ponds called impoundments, or they pump them back underground into abandoned mine shafts. And what Jennifer claims, as well as her community, is that the water has filtered out of those mine shafts and those big lagoons and destroyed the local water supplies, which they use for drinking.
So she and 264 neighbors sued?
That's right. That's right. They've sued the nine coal companies asking for compensation.
And where do the state regulators stand in her case and then go national?
In her case, state regulators say that they cannot find sufficient scientific evidence to show that what the coal companies are pumping underground has ruined the water supplies of local residents. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that the coal companies themselves admit that they've broken the law. These companies around Jennifer's home, they can't put stuff underground that violates the Safe Drinking Water Act. And they file reports each month saying what's in their injections. And we know from their own reports that that has broken the Safe Drinking Water Act. They've been against the law, and they told the state that every month. But the state didn't do anything. They didn't punish them. In fact, the state says that they basically overlooked the records, and they didn't even realize that these guys were breaking the law. And that's what's happening all across the country, is that every single month or every single week or every single quarter, companies send in reports, and they say, this is what I'm dumping into a river, or this is what I'm dumping into a pond. And it shows that they're breaking the law. But in most cases, regulators either don't look at the report, or even if they see the report, they're not doing anything to punish them.
And it's not just coal companies. I mean, the figures you're talking about here are astounding. Chemical companies have violated the Clean Water Act 500,000 times.
Right.
Most of the violations go unpunished.
And just to be, it's not just chemical companies. It's facilities of any kind. So a lot of the polluters are, for instance, gas stations, dry cleaning stores, wastewater treatment plants that are run by New York City or any other city. These are all facilities that, under the Clean Water Act, are supposed to limit the toxins and other chemicals and pollutants that they dump into rivers or lakes or ponds. And they measure each week or each month what they're dumping, and they tell regulators, but regulators just aren't acting on that.
How did over 23 million people get exposed to unsafe drinking water?
So that what we did is we looked at all of the numbers from the EPA and from the USGS, the Geological Survey, on how many water districts or wells had violated health-based standards or weren't in conformance with health-based standards, because wells aren't regulated for the most part under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that's the figure that we arrived at, is that all of these people were exposed to water that either contained bacteria, parasites, viruses, and in fact, one study says that almost 20 million people a year get ill just from consuming those types of things in their water. And then on the other hand, that's just sort of the bugs that we know about in water. There's also all these chemicals and toxins, carcinogens that can build up in your body and maybe don't make you sick right away, but over decades can accumulate and cause things we know like cancers, organ failures, and other really scary diseases.
Now, you have compiled, with the Times, a national database of water pollution violations.
Right.
Explain how people can get access to this.
If you go to nytimes.com/water, you'll see a link that lets you find your own state. And what you can do is you can put in your own zip code and look up who around you has violated the Clean Water Act. And then you can also download all of this data from the states. One of the things that we found that was really troubling was that we went to the EPA to try and ask them for this information to figure out what's going on. And the EPA's records weren't great, because when we went to the states would say, no, the EPA is completely wrong. We have all these other violations that the EPA doesn't know about. And so we asked every single state, send us all of your data. And then we put it all together, and that's
so
what we can...
So your information at the Times database here of polluted water around this country and drinking water is more extensive than the EPA's?
It's more comprehensive than what the EPA has.
Why aren't the regulators doing more? What needs to be done?
Well, I think that there's two things, and this is a problem that started under the Clinton administration, so it's not just a Republican or Democrat issue. Two things have happened. The first is that water cleanliness just didn't stop being a priority for the federal government. There were a lot of other issues that came up, and they started focusing on that, particularly air pollution and other things like that. Or under the Bush administration, there just wasn't a lot of economic support for regulatory activities in general. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that over the last decade or so, Congress has created a whole bunch of new rules saying, we now want state environmental agencies to focus on new types of things. Stormwater runoff, the types of pollution that goes through sewers. And they said, go worry about these problems in addition, but we're not going to give you any more money to staff up. So as a result, taking New York as an example, the number of facilities that regulators have to oversee has doubled in the last decade to about 19,000 facilities. But the number of inspections that are done every year has stayed exactly the same, because their budget has actually declined each year on an inflation-adjusted basis. So as a result, you have people who are entirely well-meaning, they're officials who want to be out there policing, but there's only so many hours in the day, and so they miss a lot.
Finally, the issue of the media doing the work that the government should be doing, that the governments are resourced to do, and also the importance of investigative journalism.
Yeah. One of the things that we're enormously proud of is that a lot of the comments from readers have said, this is why we buy the Times, this is why we appreciate the Times. And, you know, as a journalist and a fairly young journalist, and I came to journalism out of business. I had gotten an MBA and started a company, and then I decided to become a journalist.
Why? Why?
Because it's a lot more fun than doing other stuff. You know, I mean, it's a tough time in journalism right now, as you know. And it's a time when, if you look at the headlines, it would seem that the future is dire. But this is the type of work that I think people really appreciate, and I think it demonstrates, A, why people should be supporting journalism, not just with reading it and talking about it, but also buying subscriptions, watching and listening to shows like this. Really, you vote with your dollars and your time, and more importantly, the type of work that we have to do.
And if people want to see in their community how the water is polluted, again, the website is?
It's nytimes.com/water.
Charles Duhigg, I want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning reporter for the New York Times. His latest piece is on the Clean Water Act and the water in your community. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Gubin. Thanks for joining us. Thanks so much.